Hi, everybody. My name is Larry Thomas, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hey.
I had kind of a bad day, too. my God. Yeah, I tell you, the 10-minute speakers at this conference have been fantastic. I mean, they've just been great. And Popo was good, too. Where's he at? Yeah. I want to thank the committee for inviting me out to be here, and it's a pleasure to be here. It's really quite an honor, and I was hoping that I would see Howard here too. I was really sad, that he couldn't be here. The last time I'd seen Howard, excuse me. You don't have to pat me on the butt. I mean, just a thank you will be all right. All right, you know. I forget we're in Palm Springs. Yeah. When they mentioned to quiet your beepers unless you're an organ donor, I just imagine talking and these beepers going off and a bunch of people whose lips have just came in or are rushing out the door. You know. I am glad to be here, but I was hoping that I would see Howard, because the last time I'd seen Howard, we had talked together a couple years ago out at Bakersfield at a roundup, and we had stayed at this Marriott, and we were sharing the hotel with 2,000 Jehovah's Witnesses. And my first night there, I had a tremendous desire to get up around 3 o'clock in the morning and grab a grapevine and go door to door. Do you know Bill and Bob love you? You know, yes. But anyway, I'm glad to be here, and I'm glad that there's new people here. And if you're new, I want to welcome you to Alcoholics Anonymous, and I hope you get a sponsor and get ready to eat a lot of chicken. Every conference, chicken, 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 man. And but I'm glad that Vince, I talked to Vince. Vince had 6 months, and we had a long talk. And I mean, as soon as I got here, Vince said, "Hey," and I said, "How you doing, Vince?" And he hasn't stopped. He's still going now, man, but I'm glad to be here and stuff like that. And if you're new, you probably feel like you're in hell, I've got some friends here. See, that was one of my biggest nightmares I shared with Alex a long time ago. One of my biggest nightmares was that I died and went to hell, and I was wandering around down there, and Satan came up to me, and he says, "Geez, Larry, why the long face?" And I said, "Well, I'm in hell." And he says, "Oh, my God, have you ever drank before?" And I said, "Well, yeah." And he says, "Well, you're going to love Mondays down here. My God, we've got whiskey, we've got rum, we've got Old English 800, we've got Thunderbird. You don't have to worry about getting cirrhosis. Hell, you're dead." "Hey," he says, "did you ever do any dope?" And I says, "Oh, a little." And he says, "Well, that's the lion that got you down here." He says, "You're going to love Tuesdays. We've got heroin, we've got crack, we've got morphine, we've got Seconal, and you don't have to worry about overdosing. Hell, you're dead." I said, "Great." He says, "Do you like to gamble?" And I go, "Yeah." And he says, "Well, you're going to love Wednesdays down here. We've got the ponies, we've got poker, we've got casinos. You don't have to worry about going broke, Larry. Hell, you're dead." He says, "Do you like to smoke?" And I said, "Sure." And he says, "Well, we got pipes, we've got Cuban cigars on Thursdays, we've got Viceroys, Camels." He says, "You're going to love Thursdays." He says, "Are you gay?" And I go, "No." And he says, "Well, you're going to hate Fridays." You know? That could be hell. I don't know. But if you're new, it's not what it seems. It's really not what it seems. And I hope that you grab a sponsor and try your best not to do this thing alone. My sponsor tells me that I'm living proof that a man can stay sober for a little over 24 years. Not amount to a damn thing. So he says, "You're not much, but you're all you think about," And I love my sponsor today. I've got a good life today. I was born in Detroit, and I come Come out to California when I was about 4 years old, and brought up in a little foster home over there in Gardena and stuff like that. And my mom was a little Scandinavian lady, and my mom loved diet pills. My mom loved speed. My mom was always buzzing around the house around 3 o'clock in the morning, you know, and raking the neighbor's yard around midnight, and, you know, out in the garage sorting nuts and bolts all night or something like that, you know. And her favorite thing was to take that speed and make Afghans. Everything in the house had a fresh Afghan on it. Chairs had Afghans, couches had Afghans. My dad's golf clubs had little poodles she knit, you know. Any animals, they had a fresh vest on, you know. And you can hear her in her room just going all night, you know. And, great lady. And one of her hobbies, when she can get him down to one, is she loved to take speed and do these big jigsaw puzzles, you know. Not the 3,000 ones, you know, the 4 million piecers, you know, of Indio, you know. And, you know, yeah, she don't want any colors. It's going to be a beige night tonight, you know. And she'd go to Save-On's and get her a carton of Raleigh cigarettes because they had coupons on the back that she saved. And she saved those coupons to buy more yarn. It was a hideous cycle she was caught up in, you know. And come home, put her one and only muumuu on, you know, and plop open that card table, take a couple more Dexies, and start putting together this puzzle, you know. And she had a big pair of toenail clippers because if she had a piece that didn't fit, well, she'd snip that little thing till it did, you know. And she had a heck of a work ethic, you know, and I tell you, my mom loved me to death. No doubt about my mom's love for me. No doubt about it, man. My dad was a happy drunk. My dad was a happy singing the blues, Nat King Cole, Bobby Darin drunk. My dad loved to drink and sneak into his own damn house. It was an amazing thing, you know, and being a refinery worker, he's always coming through my bedroom window, you know, and I had this big fear of sleeping, so I'm up anyway, you know, and boy, he'd be getting drunk and climbing through that window, and I could feel him because I could feel his big boot coming down on my chest, you know. And I remember grabbing that boot one night, and I said, God, Dad, why don't you have Mom make you a set of keys, you know? My God, she's up anyway, you know. I mean, I can hear the Hoover going now, you know. And oh, my dad was a great guy. My dad loved to get drunk and sing songs all night long, you know, just one verse. You know, you know, he would sing Mac the Knife, all, you know, oh, the shark, just that song, you know, it just drive me nuts. I wanted to come out and hit his head, you know, like it would skip him to a new verse or something, you know. But my dad was a hard-working guy. My dad was my idol for a long time. And my dad let me know that you don't know how good you got it. You don't know how good you got it, Larry. Back when I was your age, we really had it tough. You see, that's the thing I've never been able to do is I've never been one of these guys that just wake up grateful. I've never been a grateful guy. I've never been grateful. And that's one of the things that can kill me today is when I start taking credit for my sobriety. You see, once I start taking credit for this thing, I start feeling like I'm getting gypped. And I start taking things for granted. And if I take things for granted, I lose it. This thing's the grace of God. This thing has nothing to do with what my wants and stuff like that. This is a miraculous thing. I mean, Alcoholics Anonymous is the longest thing I've ever done against my will, for Christ's sakes, you know. And everything about it goes against the grain, which is why it works so damn good, you know. And my dad used to tell me, you know, you don't know how good you got it, kid. Back when I was your age, we really had it tough, and he did have it tough. My God, you know, he grew up in a depression. His father died choking on his tongue in a drunken convulsion. His mother hung herself in a Detroit jail, and he fell in love with my mom when she was 16 and got her out of that convent. And his dream was to go into the Navy and bring her out to California. He was a picky guy, you know. And his dream was to bring my mom out to California and live the good life. And I became the nightmare of that dream, you know. And how many times did I want to ask my dad how to do things, you see? But somewhere when I was growing up, I got it in my sick little head that men are supposed to figure things out themselves. You see, and I wanted my dad's approval so bad that I didn't dare ask him for help because maybe he wouldn't like me, you know. And so I tried to figure out this thing, and there were so many times I wished I could talk to my dad, you know, and I just couldn't. And around, you know, and I started building this invisible barrier between me and my old man. This little brick wall started coming up, you know. And by the time I was 11 years old, sobriety stopped working. I had about had it with life. I'm restless. I'm irritable. I'm discontented. You know, I'm physically and mentally and emotionally can't get things going. You know, I feel like I'm ugly. I'm beating myself and scarring myself up. I'm mentally doing things that everybody else is doing, but I've got this thing about me that's always telling me you're no good. You'll never make it out there. You see, one of my biggest fears that I had is I could never have a dream. I could never have a dream of what I wanted to be when I grow up. Because the first time I had a dream of something that I wanted to attain to, I talked myself out of it in 15 minutes, and I felt so weird about doing that. Talking myself out of things because, oh, what are you doing? You'll never be a cameraman, you know? And staying up all night and wishing that I could sleep and stuff like that. And around 11 years old, there's about four of us, and we're in a garage, and we start passing around a bottle of Four Rose whiskey. And for the first time in my life, my physical and the mental and emotional things blended. And for the first time in my life, I could connect happiness with something. And that was going to be my dream until I come to Alcoholics Anonymous. And even after, is that one of these days, I'm going to think and feel and be normal. Because I know there's something about me that isn't. Oh, sure, I can do all these things that everybody else is doing. But I know there's a piece of me that just ain't right. And when I take a drink of alcohol, something makes it all right. Now, when I was 11 years old, I didn't head out to Skid Row or anything like that. But I got the address, you know. And it wasn't like I was, the pressures of a paper route drove me to drink at 11 and stuff like that, you know. But I never forgot that connection. I never forgot that connection. And the older I got and the more I ran from responsibility, the more I knew that I found my ace in the hole in drinking. And drinking was just a beautiful thing for a guy like me. For a long, long time, every time I drank, there would be this big, beautiful window. Every time I drank, this big, beautiful window would open up. And the older I got and the more I drank, the smaller that window got and the more my dependence on it got. And by the time I come to Alcoholics Anonymous, I was just hoping for a little peek through a keyhole. I was hoping I would just get a second of big picture window. And when by the time Alcoholics Anonymous and everything started coming into my life, I was just hoping one day, somehow, someday, I could just get a little bit of relief. Somehow, someday, I would just take just a little bit. The window wasn't opening again. You see, but hitting the bottom for me isn't enough to drive me to Alcoholics Anonymous. Me and Vince were talking about that today. He says, how come every time I come to AA, I'm desperate, but after about 90 days, my desperation wears off? My God, that's the nightmare of the alcoholic. You see, if you're new and your best friend's drinking and your biggest enemy is sobriety, I want to welcome you to Alcoholics Anonymous. You see, because sobriety drove me to drink time and time and time again. I couldn't stand the way that I felt when I was sober. And I would get sober and I'd show up to Alcoholics Anonymous and I'd see these clowns with these ties on saying, 30 days ago, I was on the streets of Los Angeles. Now I'm the president of the Bank of America. Thank you, you know. My God, I came in with that guy, you know. But I had no idea what they were doing, you see. I had no idea. And like I said, I'd had my first drink, and I always knew where to get it and what to do with it and stuff like that. And by the time I got into high school, I remember being a freshman, and I started dating this little Mexican girl, and she had some brothers who liked cars, and I liked cars, and I started hanging around these guys, and we started drinking that wine and lowering our Chevrolets down to the ground and getting our hair big like a Bakersfield tumbleweed, you know, and driving around listening to the Four Tops and the Temptations and Marvin Gaye, and God, I loved it, man. I was in my plumbing truck not too long ago, and the Four Tops came on, I just start sinking in my damn truck, man. I loved it. I had a Mexican girlfriend named Lupi, and she had her hair up real big, and I'd get my hair up real big with these white t-shirts and black khaki pants that came up to here. Some of the ladies were telling me that men who are well endowed had big feet, so I had a pair of 15-inch shoes, you know. I'd be driving around with my big hair and big ideas, you know, showing my big feet out the window, you know. God, I loved it, man. We'd bounce around. I remember one night we got so drunk, I drove into the Jack in the Box, you know, and I pulled up to there, and, you know, my buddy Rudy would go, oh, go ahead and order, you know, and I can't even see the puppet, you know, and I can hear the puppet, you know, and can I have your order, please? Start yelling at me, the little creep, you know, so I'm just loaded to the gills, and I go in there, and I hear this big crash, and I ran over the dang puppet. The puppet's hanging down, you know. The cops come, they arrest me, they throw my hair on the car, I shatter it, you know, and I don't drive till I'm 30. Well, big deal, you know. You can always ride shotgun, and there's nothing like driving shotgun. Let Rudy drive all night, man. And there's nothing like that alky sitting in that passenger seat, just drinking the whole night away and staring at the most magnificent thing he's ever seen, and that's himself in that little damn mirror, man. You want to get an alky's attention, put a mirror in front of him, man. I came down here tonight at 7:15 because for an hour I was stuck in front of that damn mirror, man. Here it is 100 degrees out, and I'm thinking, do I need more hairspray? A little more, you know what I mean? I love it. And the more I drank, the bigger my hair got, you know. And at the end of the evening, man, I'd be driving around thinking, what am I doing with these Mexicans, man, you know? I ought to be an underwear model, for Christ's sakes, you know? I don't wear any, but what the hell, you know? And see yourself in that mirror, and your hair is all big. It's got cigarette butt stuck in it, you know? You got a bunch of puke on your T-shirt, and you're feeling foxy, you know? I feel like dancing when I look like that, you know? And I love driving around like that, and driving around with those gangs, man. You always got to prove yourself. And I remember one night I'm sitting in the back seat, and there's about four of us. We look like the seven dwarfs bouncing around, you know? All got hair and big frowns on our face because our asses hurt from bouncing around all night, you know? And we find out that some guy stole some stuff from one of our buddies, man. So about four of us were going to drive out to Whittier and get this guy. And we're all bouncing around, and I got this big Life magazine with a big pipe in there, you know? And I'm thinking we're all going to get these guys, right? All for one for all, you know, unity, that kind of thing, you know? We pull into Whittier, and there's this guy in the back, man. And all the way up there, man, we're drinking that Thunderbird and what we're going to do and what we're going to do, you know? And by the time we get there, man, I'm all ready. Now, I don't know about you. Everything good that happens in my life just clips on by. Anything that's bad going clicks into slow motion, you know what I mean? So these guys pull up into the back of this liquor store, and the guy's in the back of the liquor store in the back of the parking lot. And he's a big Samoan fella, you know? He's about 6'9", 520 pounds, you know? His feet are this thick, you know? And these guys open the door, and they go, go get him, Larry, you know? And I'm thinking these guys are coming with me, you know? I've got this pipe in this magazine, and it clicks into slow motion. And all of a sudden, I see this pipe fall out of this magazine, you know? And I'm getting ready to kick ass with a Life magazine, you know? I tell you, that guy kicked my little rear for 5 days, man, you know? All I could see was chunks of stuff. And the only thought that I had is, you know, when he's done, I'm going to kick his ass, you know? I don't know about surrender, you know, but I was loving it, man. I love bouncing around those cars, man. Getting ready for those weekend parties, get all loaded up on your wine, you know, and you and your buddies are, I remember it's July 4th, we're going to drive up to Pismo Beach, man. Going to drive up there, big car show up there, big lowrider had a big car show up there, and a bunch of us were getting in this guy's car, we're bouncing up to Pismo Beach, man, we're drinking. Hell, you know, a day and a half later, I wake up and I'm in the Yuma County Jail. I don't know what the hell happened, man, you know, and I'm chained to this one guy that looks like Paul over there, you know, and then on the other end of me is this little Mexican guy, this guy's about 50 years old, he got chunks of his hair pulled out, you know, he's got three teeth, he's all beat up, he got snot and blood, and little white shirt with tortilla sauce all over it, you know, got oatmeal and stuff on his pants, and he's chained to me, and he's looking at me, and he goes, hey, widow. You had a bad night, you know? Me, you know? What the hell happened to you, man, you know? Oh, I loved it, man. Around 1969, all these guys are going different places, you know? Some of them are going to Vietnam, and some of them are turning hippie and going to San Francisco, and I thought, well, what am I going to do with my life? And I thought, well, you know, maybe I'll go find my roots in Detroit. So me and my buddy, you know, head off to Detroit, and we wound up at Phoenix. Yeah, we're over there on North Central and Roosevelt at the Apache Hotel, you know? You know, and Apache's got about 8 floors. Everybody's, you know, they got these little rooms, about $30 a month, right? You know, you got a hot plate and a hot TV in there, you know. You got a Murphy bed that folds down. On one side's a window, on the other side's a sink. And I stick my head out that little window, and my morning starts at about 4 o'clock, and I drink and I dream and I die. And I know one of these days things are going to be different. One of these days it's all going to change. One of these days I'm going to have some type of normal life and everything will be all right. You know what I mean? I'm just going to matter of getting some things together. And my morning drinking is starting earlier and earlier and earlier, you know. And I finally had to get a job. And I remember getting this job with this plumber, you know. And he stuck me, the first day he stuck me underneath this house, you know. And he wanted me to string some pipe. We were doing a remodel. He says, I don't want you to do anything. I just want you to string the pipe. You know, and then he took off, and I'm underneath this house, and I got a pint of Kessler's, I got a radio, and then there's this cat staring at me, you know. Never had a cat, you know, and I'm underneath this house, and I got this pint of Kessler's, and I go crawling over to the vent, you know, in the house, and I look out, you know, and I go, God damn it, man, I got it made under here, you know. I'm on top of the world, man. I got a pint of Kessler's, I got a radio, I got a cat, you know. Every now and then I bang on the pipe to let them know I'm under there, you know, and I, man, cap that seal. 9 hours later, they're dragging me out of there, you know. It seems like I blacked out and I passed out and I went up through the bedroom window of the lady's house and I went through her room and I grabbed all of her jewelry and some clothes and I took them underneath the house, you know, and they dragged me out of there. The cats all got jewelry on them and stuff like that, you know. I get fired from that job, you know. So I go down to the Wagon Wheel Bar, you know, and I love going down to that bar because that bar's like Halloween to me. I know once I'm in there and I have 3 Boilermakers, I'm going to be somebody. I'm going to be a plumber. I'm going to be I'll be somebody. I ain't going to be me, which is the goal. I know I'm going to be somebody, and I know this goof that I'm drinking with is going to be somebody too. And the night's on, you know, and the night's on. And then after I meet a guy named Ernie, he gets me a little job, and he gets me a job as a tuxedo salesman down there, you know, and I start selling tuxedos in the middle of July in Phoenix, door to door, you know. Hey, Betty, look at this guy, you know. And so that lasted for a couple hours, and then Ernie, this guy that I met from Tennessee down there at the bar, he says, Larry, he says, I know how we're going to make some money. He says, not too far from here is a horse track. He says, we're going to get you down to 95 pounds, and you're going to be a jockey, you know. And I said, all right, I'm going to start working out and stuff like that, you know. And this guy had a bag of some speed. Now, I've never taken this stuff, you know. I'm just minding my own business, drinking some cheap wine and doing heroin. And I didn't know it, you know. I want you to take this stuff, and you know, and in 2 months we'll come back and we'll weigh you in. And I says, all right, and he took off, you know. And so a week later he came by, and I'm in the same doorway. I don't want to be a jockey, Ernie. I'm going faster than any damn horse I've ever seen in my life, you know. And I'm all sucked in. I've been chasing flies in my room, you know. Looking out my little window, seeing these black and white flashes. That's the sun going up and down, you know. You couldn't have possibly taken that. Well, I did, and I want some more, goddammit. You know, I just sucked in, you know. So I finally got me a little job with another plumber, and I'm digging a ditch for a couple hours, and I find out that the guy's younger than me. Well, I did what any man with character would do, as I faked a knee injury, you know, and he took me to the hospital there, and they gave me some prescription stuff, and me and Ernie met these guys down at the bar, and they knew some guys in Nogales, and long story short is I started writing prescriptions and selling them, writing prescriptions for Seconal and Nembutal and, you know, Amitol, you know it all. I mean, I took it all too, you know, And after about 9 months, they caught up with us. And now, you know, when you're on barbiturates and whiskey, there's no freeway chase, you know. There he goes, down to 605, you know, and none of that's happening, you know. Just a matter of the sheriff coming into the Busy Bee Hotel going, well, there he is under there, you know. So they tried and convicted me, and they put me away in southern Arizona for a little while, and they gave me a $45 voucher to come back to Los Angeles. In 1974, I go to the L.A. City Hall, and I register down there. And they give me a little voucher for the Greyhound Hotel in downtown Torrance. And I'm about a month sober, and And I meet a little girl that I hadn't seen for a long time, and that's my little sister. I had two sisters, and I didn't know that they had loved and adored me. I had two sisters, and I had no idea that I was their idol, and they used to, and that they liked me. And I met this little sister I hadn't seen for a long time, and her husband had the opportunity of a lifetime, and that is they were going to go to Monterey, California. And they were going to look at some houses because she was getting a job opportunity. But she couldn't take her dog. And she wanted to know if I could do her a favor. She says, I need you to do me a favor. And I'm so glad that you're sober and able to do it. She says, we got to go look at some houses. And I want you to house sit from Friday to Monday. And all you got to do is bring in the mail and feed the dog. She says, I can't pay you. But everything you want is in this house. But just bring in the mail and feed the dog. Can you do it? And I would say, Debbie, don't you guys worry about a thing. I mean, go leave early. Everything is, don't worry. It's in good hands. You know what I mean? And Friday morning, she takes off, man. And I get to get in my good graces. You know what I mean? And so I walk the dog until he's frothing at the mouth, you know. And I bring in her mail. I read it for her, you know. And Saturday morning, I get the Daily Breeze newspaper, and there's going to be an Ali fight. And I love watching Ali fights, you know, but I'm used to watching them with Jiffy Pop and Thunderbird wine, you know. And I know I can't do that, though, because Debbie needs some stuff done. And I start thinking about this all day. I start thinking about that Thunderbird wine. I think about that Thunderbird wine, and it's just like a piston in an engine, you know what I mean? And besides, I don't have no money. I don't have no money to do this. And I start going through her little house. I start ripping through her little house and going through her drawers. Around 1 o'clock, I stumble into a room and I find a sparkless bottle full of pennies. And I start shaking that bottle out till I get enough money for some Thunderbird wine, shake a little more out for some popcorn. I go down to Hans Liquor Store and I get me that little quart of Thunderbird wine. And I come back to that house, turn on that tube, cap the seal, and that's all I remember until Monday morning. Her husband's dragging me out of the house, and I'm hitting the steps. And as I'm going through the house, and he's dragging me, I'm going by a couch, and there's a knife, and it's all ripped open. I'm going by a TV, and the tube has been busted. I'm going by a picture window, and the curtains are going through it because it's cracked. He's bouncing me down the back steps to my little sister's feet, whose hands in her head, and she's sobbing a cry that I could hear around the world because the gate's open and her dog's gone. And the only thought that she says, get him out of my sight. Get him out of my sight. Because an alcoholic of my type has never been told anything by anybody that he hasn't told himself at midnight when he's alone. The book talks about a mysterious barrier between me and my fellow man. It's mysterious to them, but baby, I know what's on that wall. It's every little nightmare that keeps me up at night. Every little nickel and dime thing that I've ever done to anybody in my life is right there, you see. Breaking my mom's heart time after time after time. That little lady, there was one time I was coming out of an institution. She hadn't seen me for a long time. And I'm standing at this dry cleaner's parking lot from here to that back door, and it's raining out, and I got my street mud on. And the only thought that I have is she better have a dollar for me to walk over to my mom and have her open up this little plastic purse that she got at Woolworths, to start fumbling through it to see a picture of me when I'm 8 years old playing Little League. To go through her $1 and $2, and she gives me that $2, just shaking it. And I grab that money, and I turn, and I start walking off, and she says, Larry, what would it cost to get my son back? For me to take off running to go down to a carport that I was staying in. See, the guy, the big macho lowrider, has a little motel room at Coco Palms in Lameda, but I'm too afraid to stay in there, so I've been sleeping in carports, you see. I never want to forget how it was to be 16 years old and me and my dad are fighting. Me and my dad are fighting because he's kicking me out of the house because I got caught selling dope at high school. And he says, you want to live that way, that's your business, but I got two daughters and a wife. He says, why don't you get the heck out of here? And I went after the old man. And I never forgot that. See, I never forgot that. I would joke about that in bars, and I would joke about that to guys in jail. But when I come to Alcoholics Anonymous, the thing that made me full of shame was the physical contact that I had on my mother and father. I never want to forget being in my mom's house and knocking on her door at midnight, and she's watching Johnny Carson, and she hadn't seen me for a while, and I got my street mud on, and she invites me into the house. And she lays my head on her lap, and she starts rocking. She starts praying to this God that she found in Detroit, please watch my baby boy. And I can feel her tears dropping down and hitting me on my head. And I'm saying, Mom, it ain't that bad. It ain't that bad, Mom. Things are going to work out. because I had the same obsession that I had when I was new and I come to Alcoholics Anonymous. And if you're new, I hope you'll be aware of this because it was tricky to me. I would come to these meetings and I would see people, and to the untrained eye, it looks like people come here and they stop drinking. They get a little job and they get a little apartment and they get a little car and they get somebody to dance with. And to the untrained eye, it looks like the treatment for alcoholism is normal living. And nothing could be further from the truth. That those things are just a matter of hard work and good fortune. But the treatment for alcoholism is exactly what we're doing here and exactly what we should be doing every day. It's you and that guy and that book. That's the only solution there is for a guy like me, is the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. One of my favorite pictures is the guy on the bed. Those two guys on the bed. Now, do you really think they're telling that guy, boy, you need a new job? I don't think that's what they had in mind, you know. I don't ever want to forget that the solution to my disease is intensive work in this thing right here. This stuff right here is the treatment for my disease. Normal living is not the treatment for alcoholism, you know, because there's people sitting in this meeting tonight, and one that I sponsor, who has every material instinct satisfied in his life. He is a poster child for normal living. Yet he is restless and irritable and discontented, and he can't figure out what the heck's wrong with him. But he hasn't applied some of these things, and he's not giving this thing away. Just stagnant here, you know. I don't ever want to forget those things, you know. And like I say, I got that room over there, and they violated me, and they sent me up to Wayside for a little bit. And I'm going to do about 3 or 4 months, and I'm getting ready to get cut loose, and these guys are talking about going back to their families. These guys are talking about getting out and going back to the neighborhood. These guys are talking about getting out and going back to their jobs. And I'm up there for 4 months, and the only thought that I have is I got a half pint of Kessler's hidden in a tree on Crenshaw Boulevard. And every night I'm thinking about that half pint. Every night I'm thinking about how I'm going to get out, go to the fourth tree in the fifth row and dig that thing up, and I'll have my half pint. I thought about that for 4 months, man, every night. Come on, baby, I'm coming home, man, you know. I'm coming to get you, baby, you know, and have that RTD bus let me out and go running down 190th and finding that tree and digging it up, and it ain't there. Finding that next tree and digging it up, and it ain't there. After about 4 trees, the cops come, and they know I'm not a gardener, you know. And they arrest me, and they violate me, and I'm up there for a little bit, and I get cut loose again, and I'm sober for about 2 months. And in 1975, they find me in a little dugout over there in El Segundo Boulevard, in El Segundo, a little league field. Absolutely sober, in between hysterical and maniacal. They take me to the Harbor General Hospital, and they diagnose that some of my drug overdoses have been suicide attempts, and by the looks of my jacket, that I need to go to a state hospital and be observed for about 30 days. So they rolled me up, and they sent me to a state hospital out there for Camarillo, and about a year later, they let me out, totally observed, you know. And they gave me my little bottle of antidepressants and my anti-anxiety pills, and they told me under no certain terms would I ever be able to operate without taking those things, and they were absolutely right. Because after about 2 months, I ran out of Thorazine, and they found me over there at Alvaro Street behind the Chevron station, and they rolled me up, and they sent me up to Wayside. And after about 2 months, there's about 50 of us, and we go to the South Bay Courthouse, where I'm going to be tried and convicted. And at 4 o'clock in the afternoon, I'm sitting in a holding tank, and there's nothing but me and bologna sandwiches. And I'm praying for the only thing that I could pray for, and that is maybe some keys. I can hear some keys. And around 4 o'clock in the afternoon, a Scottish man with a patch opened up a jail door. Rolled open that jail door, and he said, "Are you Larry Thomas?" And I said, "Yes, sir, I am." He says, "Come with me, son. You're going to AA." And I said, "My God, what's AA? I've heard of OR and PO, but what's AA, you know? And who's this damn pirate, you know? I mean, you guys had just introduced me to what they call a trusted servant. Because he had no business being there. He wasn't elected. He wasn't nominated. He wasn't a part of a panel. He wasn't a probation officer. He was a little refinery worker who had just gotten some of the worst news he had in a long time. And he knew that he needed some help. And somewhere in his literature and his practices of Alcoholics Anonymous, he grasped and developed a manner of living which ensured him immunity from drinking was intensive work with other alcoholics. He knew he didn't know to go to work anymore. He knew he didn't need another scholarship. He didn't need to rock another grandchild. He needed intensive work with an alcoholic. And he went down to that jail, and he had talked to Judge Foy and Judge Hollingsworth, and he says, "I think we got a guy for you." And he came down there, and he took me to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I was ready for a long ride and maybe some lunch. And that guy took me for a 15-minute car ride to my first meeting. And in that car, he told me the most miraculous thing I'd ever heard in my life. He says, "Son, I know you've had a hell of a life." And he says, "I know you feel different." He says, "I understand that. I felt different my entire life." He says, "Son, in Alcoholics Anonymous," he says, "I need you to know one thing." He says, "The more different you feel, the more qualified you are." He says, "Nobody comes here happy and well-adjusted." That's just what the Al-Anons feel when they see you leave, you know. And that man took me to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And he rolled up to this little club called the TLC Club and introduced me to a little lady named Moose and Captain Bob and Tennessee Bill and Singing Sam and Serenity Sam and Bicycle Ray and Santa Claus Ray and Dancing Pete and Whistling Butt and all these other people, you know. Everybody had a nickname and a tattoo, and they were coming after me with their big smiles and dirty hands, you know. And little Moose came after me like a toilet paper commercial. She came running after me. She says, "Hi, honey, my name is Moose, and I'm expecting a miracle." I said, "I bet you are." I said, "I'm not it, you know." Some transvestite came out of the card room. He started circling me like a cop helicopter, you know, and he... After about the third time around, he landed. He come wandering up to me, and he says, "You know, I can't wait to take you to a candlelight meeting." Yeah. I said, "I don't think so, you know. Not till I get a year anyway, you know." I said, "Alex," I said, "my God, that guy's got big feet, you know." And from 1975 to 1982, I came in and out of Alcoholics Anonymous on a regular basis. 30 days and get drunk, and 90 days and get drunk, and the longest I could stay sober was 6 months because I was on heroin. And every time I came back, I was desperate. And in our book, Alcoholics Anonymous, in the latter pages in the 100s, it talks about he had a desperate desire to stop. And knowing perfectly well how abnormal he was, he didn't know what it meant to be an alcoholic. You see, all this time I've been thinking I'm an alcoholic, I can't drink. I'm an alcoholic, I can't drink, I shouldn't drink. I've come to believe that I'm an alcoholic and I'm going to drink. And there's nothing going to keep me from drinking. I'm 24 years sober and I can drink. I'll never get so sober that I can't get drunk again. But I can get so drunk that I can't make it back. I hope I never forget that. Alex was, well, thank you, sir. Alex told me about a friend of his that was up, had 44 years, and now he's up in Oregon struggling to get a couple months. And Alex asked him, "What happened? You had so many years." And he says, "I did. I had a lot of years, but I didn't have any days. It's the days. I got a daily reprieve." And coming in and out of Alcoholics Anonymous, every time I would call Alcoholics Anonymous, somebody would come and get me, and they were always clean and they were sharp. And one of the finest things I can feel today is getting cleaned up coming to see you. It starts a whole pattern of out of self for you. It has a whole pattern of extra effort. You see, because I don't know nothing about extra effort. You see, besides being an alcoholic, I got a 5-inch belt of lazy ass that straps around here. All my life, I've had the type of ego coupled with this laziness that I do average things expecting standing ovations. Yeah, I'm the type of guy that'll go to work and I think the boss is up in the office going, "Oh, Jesus Christ. Oh, my God. They don't make them like that anymore. My God. And he took a half-hour lunch, too. You're kidding me, you know?" Yeah, I'm like that today. Heck yeah, I put a toilet seat on for Rosie not too long ago. And we're busy in Alcoholics Anonymous. And every time we'd come back from our meetings, she would go into the bathroom and I'd go into the bedroom. And I'd start rocking. And I would think to myself, good God, lady, get out of yourself. That's a brand new piece of wood you're sitting on in there, you know? How selfish can you be, you know? What are they teaching you there at those women's stag meetings, you know? Who do you think put that toilet seat on, God? Heck no, it was old Lawrence of Torrance that put that thing on there, you know? I finally had to tell her after a couple months. I says, you know, that's a new piece of wood you're sitting on in there, you know? She says, I know, and it's loose, too. There's no pleasing them, you know? There's no pleasing these gals, you know? It's getting to the point now that I'm so lazy that she has to con me to do stuff around the house, you know? Yeah. I have to get money to mow the lawn, for Christ's sake, you know? I wind up doing stuff, but man, I kick and I scream, you know? She wanted me to fix a clock on the oven not too long ago. Oh my God, you got enough watches around the damn house, you know? But it's a new stove, so I'm looking at this thing, you know, and I'm making all these faces and I'm yelling all these names at it like it's alive, you know what I mean? And she's leaning on the stove and she's looking at me while I'm tossing and turning, and she says, do you know how sexy you look when you're working? I said, hell yes, I do. You know? Ladies and gentlemen of the jury, I came that close to buying the most biggest con that was ever laid on me, you know? The old chores through my drawers program that they have, you know? Just, I haven't lifted a finger since then, man, you know? But, you know, that's the way I was. And coming to Alcoholics Anonymous, I didn't know anything about it. I've had my hand out my entire life. And like I said, in 1980, there's a guy doing this 12-step job, and I'm over there at the Don Hotel. I'm on the third floor. I got a hot plate and a hot TV. You know, I'm watching Jeopardy, and I got a half pint of bourbon cut in half. I'm watching Jeopardy so I could really feel like an idiot, you know. Every now and then I get one right. You know, Donald Duck, hey, I am a smart man, you know. About 10 o'clock in the morning, and I hear this, Larry, it's Don. Oh, my God, it's a guy from AA. I didn't even call him, and he's coming over here, you know. And he opened up the door, and he says, oh, my God. He said, you had 15 days, kid. You had 15 days. You're going to be a janitor in the city of Lomita. There's some hope for you, Vince, you know. And I took a shot off of that bourbon, and I told Don with all the sincerity. I said, Don, I don't want what you have. I don't want what you got. And if I ever get that bad, I'll know what to do. Why don't you get the heck out of my room and let me do what I want to. The cry of this alcoholic for my entire life. Let me do what I want to do. Nobody's going to tell me what to do. That'll be a cold day in hell before I get another man a cup of coffee. It'll be a cold day in hell before I help set up a meeting or be a literature person, get a sponsor. It'll be a cold day in hell. And if you're new, I'm secretly praying for that cold day in hell. You see, because in the back of my little egocentric mind, Alcoholics Anonymous always looked like a step down. And something happened on that last drunk. It wasn't my worst drunk, and it wasn't my longest drunk, but it was a drunk that drank away the debate of whether or not I was going to do these things. And for some silly reason, it began to look like a step up. This thing started looking real good. On May 2nd, 1982, I'm going by a Woolworth window, and I catch eyes with the thing, and the thing's about 120 pounds. I got my little wine bottle in my pocket. I got my long little hair on, and I'm staring at myself in this Woolworth window, and I said, my God, whatever happened to my dreams? All I ever wanted to be was a cameraman. And I did what I always did when I got that way. I panhandled some money and called Alcoholics Anonymous. I called Central Office, and who do I get? I get Don. Don, this is Larry. I'm checked in down here at the mission. I'm ready to come back to Alcoholics Anonymous. Will you come and get me? And he told me the most profound thing I've ever heard in my life. He said, no. He says, you know where we are. You know what we got. Why don't you get your rusty rear down here yourself? I'm tired of chasing after you. And he hung up. I said, my God, whatever happened to that AA love, you know? And I just heard it. And for the first time in my life, it was up to me to come to you. It was no longer necessary for the good people in Alcoholics Anonymous to come and get me. Now it was my turn to come to you. The most miraculous step I ever took in this program of alcoholics was the one towards you. It was when I started marching with you. It's when I started doing the things in Alcoholics Anonymous. And on May 2nd, 1982, I took the longest walk of my life. It was about 10 miles. I walked up to this little TLC club. I knocked on the door because I was banned from the club. And I said, is Don in there? And they said, well, there's a meeting starting in a half hour. You better come in and get him. And I waddled up to that guy, and I walked across that little thing, and he was in the coffee bar. And I said, Don, I don't know what to do with my life. Would you be my sponsor? And that guy lit up like a chandelier for about 5 seconds, and then he lit into me for about 20 minutes, you know. And under no certain terms was he going to put up with my nonsense. And he took me in. The guy became my sponsor. And I trusted that guy with my life. Because I had been my own product for 30, and I said, you know what, I'm going to let this guy have me. Whatever he wants to do is fine with me. And we worked the steps, and within a short time, he lit a fire. He lit a fire in me. I had a fire in me for Alcoholics Anonymous that I'd never had before. But the problem with me is that I wasn't hanging around anybody that was fanning the fire. And that's what seems to be the difficulties if you're new today. Half your head's telling you, I don't want to be here. And half the people in the meetings are telling you, you don't have to be. I hope you're not around anybody like that. I started hanging around people. The most miraculous thing that could happen, you talk about the father of coincidence, is when your sponsor lights the fire and your home group fans it. And they're pulling you along. And when they're feeling crappy, you can pull them along. And when you're feeling crappy, you can pull them along. But my God, at least you're pulling each other to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. At least you're pulling yourself to these meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous where this atmosphere that has never been created before is being created right here. Because we've come to believe in certain things. We come to believe. The most beautiful process that can happen to an alkie is when he starts coming to believe in something other than whiskey. That was the biggest surrender I ever made, was letting this guy run my life. As big of a loser as I was, the hardest surrender I made was to that guy. And I come to believe in this thing called Alcoholics Anonymous, but I had to take the actions first. I had to do that inventory, and I took that inventory with that man, and I made amends to my mother. It wasn't until I made amends to my mom that I was pushing women around, and I was abusing women, and I was yelling at them, and I had no respect for them. And what happened to me is I made amends to my mom. And these women weren't frightening to me anymore. And for a long time, it was just one little afternoon, I sat with my mom, and she just hugged me and welcomed me back into her life. She was scared to death of me. You see, because I'd smack her around and get blood out of her nose, demanding that she come up with a bottle that she'd hidden just to see that I'd poured it out in the trash. And she didn't want no part of me. But the men in Alcoholics Anonymous told me, you keep going over there and you see her. And I would see her, and I still see her, and I show up. And last week, my mom was at our house. My mom had never been in a house of mine. I'd never had a house. Christ, she's used to visiting me through a hole, you know. And my mom's standing in this house that me and Rosie have. And I asked my mom, I says, is there anything in the backyard that you would do different? She said, not a thing. This is the most beautiful yard I've ever seen. She says, this is all I've ever wanted for you. She says, I'm so happy that you have this place. I'm so happy that you're in Alcoholics Anonymous. And we hugged, and she wrapped her little arms around me. It took a long time for her because she used to hug me like that. But I show up to my mom, and I call her all the time. One of the things some of the guys that I sponsor with, some of the times they, now that we're sober, they get locked up in these other obsessions. They don't know what to do. The worst thing that an alkie can do is start talking to his obsessions. You know what I mean? And so some of these guys get caught up in something. He said, what do I do when I start thinking about this and this and this? I says, call your mom. Call another woman in your life. Call your wife and see how she's doing, you know. Break that obsession. Don't sit there trying to talk you out of the thing that's talked you in there. You know what I mean? Break the obsession, you know. Get out of that car. Go do something. And I remember one day I'd called my mom 10 times. You know, she'd, my God, what's wrong with you, you know? It wasn't too long ago, a couple years ago, my mom had this tremendous operation. She had this intestinal thing going on with her. And I went to my sponsor, and I got scared. And he says, why don't you go see her? Why don't you encourage her? Tell her that it's going to be okay, for Christ's sakes. Get out of yourself, Larry. And I went up there, and my mom was going to have this operation. And I told my mom, I said, Mom, it's going to be a piece of cake. I says, it's like getting your tonsils removed. You'll be up and running around. You're going to be okay, you know. She has intestinal bowel syndrome and stuff like that. And they went in there and they found all kinds of other stuff. And it didn't look good. And the operation went south. And the next day I went up there. And I walked up to the fifth floor and the nurse says, are you Betty's son? And I said, yes. She wants to talk to you. You know, God, you know. My mom's laid out on the bed like that, you know. And she's got hoses in her and stuff like that. And she perks up her little head and she goes like that. She goes, tonsils my ass, you know. And and one of the men that I got to make amends to was to my father. He became my best friend. He became my best friend, and it was my privilege to be with my father his last couple years. He died about 5 years ago. He died of some type of liver cancer. And my dad let me take care of his books, and every Thursday I would go over there, and we'd have chili, and I'd do my dad's books, and I would talk about, he loved to talk about the Navy. He loved the Navy, and one of the proudest moments of his life is when one day we came over there, and me and Rosie came over there, and he had all of his Navy memorabilia of Pearl Harbor and everything all spread out, all of his medals and pictures, and he was showing it like it was a museum. He was so proud of that. He was as proud of that as I was of Alcoholics Anonymous. He knew what it meant to give yourself to something. We had that in common, and he loved showing that. And on his final day, I was in his room, and he passed. And because meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, at the end of every meeting, and when I get cakes, there's men in this room who hug me and kiss me on my birthday. There's men whose hands I hold, that we say the Lord's Prayer, that when it came time to show my father love and affection, it didn't feel weird when I did it. The men taught me that. How do you make amends to a father who's now gone? How do you replace that? I find little guys that hang wallpaper in Simi Valley. I find little card sharks in Henderson, Nevada. I find little guys in Northridge. I find little guys with patches. I find a guy that I call my sponsor. I find a guy that I gave my life to called my sponsor. My sponsor, Johnny, I love that guy. See, I didn't know what to do with myself on my Thursdays now. And now on every Thursday, I pick up this little guy, and we have chili together. And he turns on the radio, and we listen to Bobby Darin, and that's my sponsor. I wanted my sponsor's approval so much when I was new. I'd come to my home group, and I'd see all these guys standing around my sponsor, and I knew he liked them better. He told me he did, you know. You know. And my sponsor would go away for the weekend, and I would call these other guys up, and I'd say, how come Johnny likes you better? And they would tell me, oh, Larry, that's not that way at all. He just knows us longer. And you don't want your sponsor's approval, for Christ's sakes. He knows you're a goof, you know. You start seeking your sponsor's approval, you're going to start holding back secrets because you want his approval. He says, get your own friends. He says, yeah. He says, you know, my God, the guy's twice your, get somebody else to be your friend, man. Keep your sponsor, you know. Just be honest with your sponsor, you know. And that helped me out a lot. Because now, 24 years later, he goes away for the weekend, and I get these new guys calling me. New guys that he sponsors. And they say, Larry, how come Johnny likes you better? And I tell them, because you're a loser. You know? But I never want to forget about being about 10 years sober and my life's coming out my sleeve. I never want to forget about that I'm going to visit my baby girl, and my baby Lauren's about 2 years old. My baby Lauren's hopping up in my lap, and she's got holes in her socks and holes in her underwear because a man in Alcoholics Anonymous can't hold a job. And you know why he can't hold a job? Because he has a resentment. You know why he has a resentment? Because his first wife that he's divorced ain't getting a cent. And you know how he makes that happen? He stays poor at her. And he doesn't hold a job, and he makes a little girl wear holy underwear. But my God, he's right. My God, he's right. She ain't going to get a cent. And my little girl gets to wear that. And she'll hop up in my arms, and she, with those little Cuban eyes, she'll say, Daddy, if you love me, why are you dressing me this way? And it started eating me up at 10 years sober. I started thinking about that gun and how well it would fit next to my head. because I couldn't stand the remorse. I'm not supposed to behave like that. I guarantee you, if you're new, if you don't change, your sobriety date will. There's no doubt about that. You can't live the way you used to live and stay sober. There's got to be a change take place. This is a spiritual program indeed. It does not mean that you need to spend your time on your knees praying, but there has to be a behavior change somewhere. And it better start with you and your actions. And I didn't know what to do because I didn't know how to hold a job. And Johnny took off for the weekend, so I called Clancy, and Clancy was my grand sponsor. He still is. He says, come down to the mission, kid, tomorrow. And he says, and we'll talk. He says, come down to my office tomorrow and we'll talk. And I says, you mean you want me to come down to the mission? And he goes, no. I want you to find an abandoned warehouse and I'll come find you, you know. So I went down to that mission and me and Clancy talked. And he gave me some cup of coffee and a carrot. And he told me about what he wanted me to do. He says, I just want you to find a little job and make the best of it. He says, quit trying to change your life by changing your address. You see, that's the only way a loser like me gets hope. I'm a loser. And you know how I've always felt like I've had to leave. That's how I change, is I leave. All my life, I've always felt like no matter where I'm at, what I'm doing, I got to leave. I got to leave. I got to leave. Like right now, I feel like I got to leave. You know what I mean? You know? I take a drink of alcohol, and I feel like staying, you know? I can stay. And Clancy told me, he says, you know, because that was my little thing in my inventory. Page after page is the only way a loser like me gets hope is he starts over. He don't know about coming to believe and working through anything. I've never worked through anything in my life. And that's what Alcoholics Anonymous, the most beautiful principle that I have today that you have given me by your examples is consistency. No matter what, I show up. No matter what, I don't leave Alcoholics in the Manners. And by doing that, I've weathered the storms. I've never weathered any storms, but that's how I've gotten faith in Alcoholics Anonymous. By listening to my sponsor, riding my problem through, and being able to look at it and say, my God, he was right. And the more you do that, the more faith you have in Alcoholics Anonymous. And that's what I have to pass on, is my experience, strength, and hope. Not some kind of workshop book that some goof made up. I have my own experience, my own. That's the only thing I have to share. And I better not be lying from this box. Because there may be a fella that may identify with me, and it better not be a lie. You better have some experience, strength, and hope. And that's exactly what this program has given me. You've taken an intense individual. You lit that fire, and you fanned it. And you know what you do with a guy who's intense and crazy? You create a thing called enthusiasm for life. Enthusiasm for a thing that's given them life. A respect for a thing called Alcoholics Anonymous, that the what you do in here has everything to do with how you're going to behave out there. If you're new, what I'm like when I leave this meeting has everything to do with me being a member without telling anybody I am. How I treat my wife and my boss and my daughter has everything to do with me being a member without telling anybody I am. And I learn it right in here. I've come to believe in your actions by watching examples who are sitting in this room tonight. The finest examples a guy that'll ever have in me. I'm watching Don, how he treats his wife. I'm watching Billy, how his commitment to Alcoholics Anonymous. I watch Bob year after year. I watch my friend Alex, who has every reason to be home tonight, and he's sitting in meetings no matter what because of one common belief. My primary purpose is to stay sober and carry this message. Our common welfare comes first. Me and you being together is the most magnificent thing I have in my life. The most magnificent have in my life is coming to visit you time and time again and watching these guys that I sponsor. Watching these guys that I sponsor come alive and watching them get to this little thing called life and then watching them sponsor somebody. Oh, it's a magnificent. A life that I would have never imagined when I was new on the back of that wall. And that me and that daughter, I started making that payments. And my daughter, Lauren, I would go to visit her. And she'd tell me that she loves me and I can handle it. My little daughter called me not too long ago. She says, Daddy, the kids are making fun of me because I'm so smart. She said, did that ever happen to you? I said, hell yeah, you know. She's 18. That last visit, man. Yeah. And you know, me and Clancy and Rosie were in New Mexico. And I told Clancy, I says, you know, I've got to make amends to my daughter. He says, for what? And I says, well, for leaving her during that divorce. I mean, she was 2 years sober. He says, well, how old is she now? And I told him, he says, well, my God, is she getting along in school? And I said, well, yeah. He says, is she personality? Is she happy and cheerful? I said, yeah. He says, does she get along with others and her mother and stuff like that? And I said, yeah. And he says, is she into drugs or anything like that? And I go, no. And he says, is her basic personality good and happy? And I said, yeah. And he says, well, why do you want to ruin that? He's, my God, she'll grow up and she'll ask you on her own. Leave her alone, for Christ's sakes, you know? And I did that, and I have done that. And every time me and Rosie go see her, because if I can talk in Sacramento, I can drive and see my little girl in Phoenix, which is more spiritual, you know what I mean? And that little girl has never wondered where her daddy is. I may not be somebody's, you know, husband, but I'll always be somebody's father, and that's that little girl. And that little girl, I love that little girl. She scared me not too long ago. I went and visited her, and at the end of our daughter-daddy dates, she raised up her little arms, and baby Lauren had a tattoo. Not just a hummingbird. Baby had the mural of the county jail right there, you know? And all I wanted to do and say, and I just shut my mouth. I called Clancy the next day, and he says, you shut your mouth. You shut your mouth, Larry. He says, I don't care. I don't care what you think. He says, don't say a thing about those tattoos every time you call her. And I didn't. But every time I call her, I'm thinking, is it still there? You know? Is it gone all the way around yet? You know what I mean? You know? But I didn't say a word. And the last time that I visited her, she showed me her tattoos. And she told me about a more important problem. You see, you folks taught me to see behind the gear. Behind the tattoos, behind the earrings, behind all that stuff, that there's a little girl in there, and she's my daughter, and I love her. And I was taught that here in meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, that no matter where you're from and what you've done and what's your sexual preference and your color, that there's an alky in there. And back behind all that stuff, you can identify with me, and I can identify with you, and that magical lost art of identification takes place where one alcoholic's talking to another, and you come to believe in a thing called Alcoholics Anonymous because you know he understands exactly how you feel. Identification. There's nothing like it. Without identification, I will not believe you. But when I started identifying with you and what you were like and what happened and what you're like you, I could come to believe in the actions you were telling me to take. And by doing that, I've been able to stay sober a little over 24 years because I've just watched you like a hawk. I was able to stay sober, and about 9 years ago, I'm speaking in a meeting in Downey. And at the end of the meeting, I lock eyes with this little Nicaraguan lady. I'd never seen anything like her before in my life. And like a lost dog, I just wandered her out to the parking lot, and I started talking to my wife, Rosie. You know, and she says, my gosh, she says, do you like the backpack? And I says, I love it. You know, I never backpacked in my entire life, man, you know. I've spent enough time out there on the benches, you know. And I've been calling that lady ever since, and we've been married for 8 years, and I love that lady. And the reason that I love her is she, and I know that she loves me. She don't need me for nothing. She's a woman in Alcoholics Anonymous. She's self-supporting. And she became the first woman that I told other women about. I love being with that lady. And what makes our little relationship work is something very simple. That when it's time for me to go to a meeting, she doesn't tug on my shirt. When it's time for her to go to a meeting, I don't tug on her blouse. And I know that I'm not the most important man in her life. I know I'm not the most important thing in her life. That Alcoholics Anonymous is number one. And Alcoholics Anonymous is number one in my life, too. I want her to have that number one. I want her to have that as number one. And we have a great life together. I love being with her, and I love seeing her happy. Everything you want that'll make you happy will be given to you by the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. Anything that hinders that happiness will be taken away by the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. You don't have to go anywhere to get anything else done. It's all right here. You find yourself a sponsor and light that fire. You find yourself a home group that'll fan it. And you stay in that atmosphere. And you do what you have to do to recreate that atmosphere so people like me and you can come in and say, you know what? I can do it here. They're happy, they're joyous, and they're free. There was a man in the Pacific group who used to sit in the front room, a guy by the name of Frank Hanna, and he used to have me talk at his meeting up in Flagstaff. And in his house, he had a beautiful house that he custom made, and in every window, you had a peak view of the mountain range. You could be in the bathroom, you could be in the kitchen, you could be in the den, and every window had a peak view. And as I stand here tonight, my friends, in every window of my life, I've got a peak view. And in every window, you're in it. In every window of my life, I can look around this room and I see people. And I think about them all the time. And the thought if there's a God or if there is a God or was a God never enters my mind anymore. Because I am in the evidence of a power greater than myself. Because table after table after table are people who should be dead. And tonight on a Saturday night, we're happy, we're joyous, and we're free. And thank you so much.
Hope you've enjoyed this recording. To obtain additional copies, receive a free catalog of AA and Al-Anon talks, or to find out about our tape and CD of the month club, call Encore Audio Archives at 1-800-878-1308 or visit our website at www.12steptapes.com.